Okay, what are we talking about right now? We started it yesterday. We're going to continue it today. Just yell it out. You don't need to have your hand raised. Empire Studies. The rise of Empire Studies. And just... this accessory is not supported by the iPad. Whatever. Aw, did it turn off already? Awesome. What are the factors that cause Empire Studies to rise? We talked sociologically, then we talked inside of New Testament studies. What were some of the sociological factors? I gave three. The sociological, the first one, global society, that through the advances of technologies, we are now able to start hearing more of the marginalized voices. Is my screen not coming on, seriously? It's this class, I don't know what it is, like the energy in this class or something just freaks out everything. It works all morning and then now, nothing. Yes, globalization. We're able to hear voices that always have been speaking, but we get to hear them more clearly now. And as a result, it critiques some of the ways in which we look at the text that we're examining. What else? Another factor. The religio-political aspect. Oh, the separation of church and state, right? How that was somewhat challenged and even demolished through things that occurred and this is American society primarily, because whenever I was talking to some British scholars and people that have grown up in the United Kingdom, they've never really had a separation of church and state phenomenon because the church has always been very much involved in the politics of the state. And that's just kind of been the way it is. Oh my gosh. Stupid thing. Okay. What else?
It began to emerge another discipline.
It did. What in particular? Empire studies began to emerge in other disciplines like
sociology.
With the works of Gerhard Linsky, for example. What else?
Literature.
With the works of Edward Said. History.
And politics.
Politics, Arif Dierlich. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so the emergence of other disciplines then starts to make the possibility of the cross-pollinization into New Testament studies more feasible. What do you find was happening at the same time in New Testament studies that primed it for the reception of Empire Studies? I gave three here, too.
Critical studies were enriched by interdisciplinary studies.
Yes. The New Testament scholars started paying attention to other studies outside of just basic biblical exegesis and theology, like sociology and anthropology. In particular, Wayne Meeks and others in that, Gerd Tyson, other ones like that. What else?
The discovery of
the Dead Sea Scrolls. The discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls enriched us because it also let us know that the way in which some documents are interacting with the empire are subversive and attacking the empire, in a sense. The War Scroll was the example we talked about the other day. And there was a third one. What was the other one? The subject's perspective. People started paying attention to the subject's perspective. And basically, the assumption that was challenged through our historical inquiry, our anthropological inquiry, actually, with James C. Scott's work, which we will talk about in detail today, was that just because we don't have recorded in the documents an actual violent uprising doesn't mean that all is well. Just because peasants aren't picking up weapons and being suppressed by the empire through a violent interaction doesn't mean all the peasants are going, gosh, the empire's so good to me. I just love it here. It is one of the things. Have you guys ever seen The Life of Brian? And they're like, ah, man, we don't. You know, what have the Romans ever done for us? And then what do they start doing? Well, they did give us roads. Oh, yeah, they did do that. They did give us aqueducts. Oh, yeah, they did do that. They start going. And what's interesting, though, is that's humorous because you almost see them their peasant complaint being turned on its head. And yet, my critique of that satire is this. They did give them roads at the cost of what? They did give them peace at the cost of what? And peace for whom? My goodness, Tacitus even says that the Pax Romana is the most feared, is to be the most feared propaganda of the empire. Why? Because peace comes with the sword. And yeah, if you're inside of the nice, comfortable confines of the city of Rome, it is peace that reigns. But if you're on the edges, if you're the subject of the empire, peace isn't what's reigning. It's the sword over your head. You see? You see how you can... Yeah, it's easy to start listing off the things that Rome accomplished and say that, see, it was the benefit for everyone. But at the cost of what? And that's a question that empire studies starts to ask. At the cost of what? Yeah, you may rule the world, but the one that rules the world doesn't just get appointed there without somebody having to fall. All empires are built on the backs of slaves of the people that are subjected to the empire. All of them. And that's what empire studies is bringing out. Okay, as a result of these different things that are developing within New Testament studies, you have a couple of major players that really push the empire studies into what we are experiencing now, right now in 2011. Is that what date it is, 2011? It's always dangerous when you say that. Sometimes I'm a couple years off. It's kind of like whenever people ask me my age. Man, like when was this? It was like 7 months ago or 8 months ago. So I was like, how old are you? I'm like, I'm 29. I was like, oh, I was going to say 35, but apparently I'm not even in my 30s yet. So anyway, 2011. Number one, a guy by the name of Christer Stendahl. Christer Stendahl. What he begins is he lays out a trajectory from which another very... Can you guys see that? Is it dark enough? Christer Stendahl. You good? Oh, okay. Okay. I see some of you straining. Okay. In his book, Paul Among Jews and Gentiles, he writes this. Now, this is an interesting insight to Romans. Listen, see if you can pick out the significance of what he is saying, the shift he's offering. He says, to me, the climax of Romans is actually chapters 9 through 11. N.T. Wright wasn't the first one to say that, by the way. He got it from Christer. Is actually chapters 9 through 11, i.e., his reflections on the relation between the church and the Jewish people, not Christianity and Judaism. What's the significance of what he's saying there? What is he offering to the understanding of Romans that oftentimes isn't offered in the understanding of Romans? Help me. Reread it. To me, Christer says, the climax of Romans is actually chapters 9 through 11. That is, or i.e., his reflections on the relation between the church and the Jewish people, not Christianity and Judaism. He says, I want to look at the text through the eyes of the people, not through the theologies we have constructed. That's a shift. He's saying, let's look at the people of the text, not the theological constructs that we put onto the texts. He said, because it is the all theology is created in communities. And it's not that the theology is inaccurate. It's not that the theology is wrong. It's that sometimes the theology can affect our interpretation, even of an entire book like Romans. Where he's saying, what we have constructed as Christianity and as Judaism, and that's how we read onto Romans what he's actually talking about. He said, instead, I want to talk about what the major issue is, and that is the relationship between the Jewish people and the Christian people, because that was the issue they're wrestling with, and Romans 9 through 11 is all about that, isn't it? How does Romans 9 begin? Paul saying, if I could give up my own salvation for the Jews, I would. But I can't. He says, because the reality is this. Not everyone that claims to be a Jew really is a Jew. Because you have to understand the definition of Israel. And then he goes on through the next three chapters to describe the definition of what Israel really means. Of who God's people really are. And his whole point is, it's not ethnicity. It's spiritual faithfulness. The covenant defines the people. That's a little crass. Not your genealogy. And Christopher Stendahl says, we'd be able to see that more clearly if we'd set aside some of our theological things that overwhelm us. That may seem like a subtle nuance, and yet, Richard Horsley says this. He says, this shift by Christopher Stendahl, This shift prepared the way for an eventual change in framework. You see what, remember, what did I start the whole lecture off yesterday with saying what we're going to describe with Empire Studies? What was I going to be trying to give to you over the next day or two? A framework from which everything that you guys are doing in your projects, everything we've talked about, we now can put it into to give us an interpretive lens that we can interact with the text in a different way. Right? And what Richard Horsley says was, what Christopher Stendhal was doing whenever he was saying, hey, maybe the theology of Romans isn't as important as the people that were caught in between the crossfires of the theology. What's important maybe is the perspective of the people. Let's look at that. Sin, this actually is an interesting segue into the next major player. The one who really picks up on this and takes it really far is a guy by the name of, I just quoted, Richard Horsley. I'm going to write it up there that way. I mean, I don't need to write Richard up there, right? You guys know how to spell that? Okay. Horsley. Matter of fact, my Mark class is reading his book called Jesus and Empire this semester. Really small book. Richard Horsley, he is the distinguished professor of liberal arts and the study of religion at the University of Massachusetts. That's always important. You need to know where the big movers and shakers in scholarship, where they're at. Why? For several reasons. Number one, their context has something to do with what they're developing. What is being developed in the UK is different than what is being developed in America, and that's just consistency. If you want to go study from here, I'm talking with the guy online right now. He's trying to figure out where to go to master's. And so he was like, what schools would you suggest? I said, this is what I would tell you to do. Look at your bookcase. Find the books that are most influential in your theology and your life. Figure out where those people are and go study there. That's how you determine a master's program. Undergrad program, the institution is more important than master's and PhD. Whenever you move on from here, this is a pedagogical tool. You're going to study under people, not going to study in a program. You hear my heart in that? The only reason why I went to Lincoln Christian Seminary is because Dr. Robert Lowry was teaching there at the time. And he was, in our movement, the top revelation scholar in existence. He had studied under I. Howard Marshall at the University of Aberdeen, and I wanted to study in revelation. So, that's where I went. That make sense? So whenever I tell you where Richard Horsley's at today, it's not just fluff. It's you need to know that stuff. Anyway, okay. Christopher Stendhal was his mentor. And what Richard Horsley develops is he starts to develop this lens of empire studies by applying it first and foremost to Paul. Basically, his argument is this, and I do, let me say this, I do think Richard Horsley overstates his case quite often, by the way. And that always happens. When scholarship's moving in one direction, they'll overstate it, and then we'll bring it back to the center eventually. But basically, he says Paul's primary purpose in many of his writings was not to argue for the religion of Christianity as superior to Judaism. But instead, he suggests that Paul was developing an anti-imperial alternative society. You see the difference in the shift there? In other words, what he's saying is, for Paul, the primary purpose of Paul was not so much to say, Christianity's better. He says the primary purpose of Paul was to say, see the empire, how do we cut out its legs? Again, I think he's a bit overstated, but it's the interpretive lens that I want us to see what's happening. Then he goes to Jesus, and basically this is how he describes Jesus. He says, Jesus is the one who launched a mission not only to heal the debilitating effects of Roman military violence and economic exploitation, but also to revitalize and rebuild the people's cultural spirit and communal vitality. Do you hear how he sees Jesus' mission? How would you react to that statement? Because it's not just important that you understand what Empire Studies is saying. You also need to understand how to interact with it. How would you interact with that statement? What is he doing with Jesus? How does he describe him there? As a political figure, absolutely. What else? Develop that. A political figure with the primary purpose of what? Societal change. And here is my caution about Horsley. A lot of times Horsley is comfortable with leaving Jesus there. That's all he did. Now here's my pushback on the people. My critique of him, I believe, is accurate. Jesus was doing something bigger than that. I think Paul was doing something bigger than just cutting out the legs of the empire. However, If you do not, in your picture of Jesus and Paul, include this imperial element, your picture is just as inaccurate. To suggest that Jesus and Paul had nothing to do with the empire, that they weren't instituting some societal changes, is simply to not pay attention to their ministries or their language. And we'll get to how I think this even intersects with Romans 13, hopefully by the end of today. Well, it's a conclusion overstated. Okay, after Richard Horsley, and in line with Richard Horsley, several other people pick up this empire studies lens. Real quick, Charlie.
Does this have to do with why Paul wanted to go to Rome?
Elaborate on that.
I don't know. I was throwing it out there. Like, mm-hmm. He wanted to establish something new, something different.
Yeah, we can at least say this. Let's play with that for a minute. We can at least say this. There's a reason why he did have a longing to go to Rome, and he wasn't just sitting here longing to go to some other random... Like, his zeal to go to Rome was different than his zeal to go to Berea. Why? Because the political hub of the entire world rests in the city of Rome, not in Berea. At the very least, what you could say is, even if you're just going to talk about missiological strategies, you can say that Paul's focus was politically driven of even where he wanted his ministry to go. Now, the pace at which it would go, he allowed God to dictate. Nevertheless, he always hit the major centers of political influence. Always. Why? Because he's offering a new political reality. One that fights differently. One that has different values in the ways of the world, one that is completely antithetical, and that ultimately what points to the salvation in Jesus. See, theology and politics don't need to be separated in this. Some people are like, man, you know, Empire Studies focuses so much on politics, I feel like that they're castrating the gospel of its theology. No, it doesn't need to be that way. It's like I was telling somebody this morning, we have to understand theology and politics are always inextricably linked. And to separate one from the other is to simply misunderstand the full picture. And when you don't have the full picture, you will have interpretations that go awry all the time. I.e. dispensationalism. Hello? What are they most focused on? We don't take the Bible literally. Actually, what they want to do is just take it spiritually. They don't, and the politics they want to apply it to have nothing to do with the politics of the ancient day. They want to apply it to, you know, our relationships with Israel. The conflation of them has implications, and the separation of them has implications. How do we conflate them? This is my question for Empire Studies. How do we hold these in tension without having one swallow up the other? That's what I want to get to. And ultimately, we're moving there. Hopefully. The other people you need to know, Warren Carter, the one that wrote your book, who is the professor of New Testament at Bright Divinity School in Fort Worth, Texas. He wrote the book, The New Testament, An Essential Guide to the Roman World and the New Testament, or something like that. He also wrote Matthew in the Margins. You don't need to know these books, but I'm just letting you know he's got other books out there. Matthew in the Margins, A Socio-Political and Religious Reading. Matthew and Empire is one of his other books written in 2001. Number two, a guy by the name of Neil Elliott is another pretty big shot when it comes to imperial studies. Things of that nature. Ooh, is it two T's? It's two T's. So fix that. He's the professor of biblical studies at the United Theological Seminary of the Twin Cities and Metropolitan State University. He's in Minnesota. That's where he's at. He wrote Liberating Paul, The Justice of God and the Politics of the Apostle. And then you have Dieter Georgi. He actually died in 2005 at the age of 75. He was the professor of religions at Harvard Divinity School from 69 to 84. And he wrote Theocracy and Paul's Praxis in Theology. Another big shot in Empire Studies, matter of fact, is N.T. Wright. What's interesting, this is actually kind of funny, Steve Moyes, he's a big shot Revelation guy. And he was telling the story that they're having a book coming out on Revelation in December called Intertextuality, Politics, and something else with the book of Revelation. And N.T. Wright wrote an article in it on Empire. And Steve Moyes said when they're all sitting around talking about how the book's going to look, he said N.T. Wright just pounded on the desk. He's like, we can't overlook the Empire. it was funny. Anyway, Steve Moyes said it was kind of like, it almost reminded him of like a Martin Luther, like, here I stand and I cannot move. Anyway, so N.T. Wright's a big player in this as well. So Before we move on to answer and ask the question, how do we examine the biblical text through the empire lens, empire studies lens, because all I've done right now is giving you the history, I want us to revisit the definition once again of what we're doing and why we're doing it. The empire studies is the interpretive framework that focuses on investigating, interrogating, and reconstructing the socio-political milieu of the author and recipient of the biblical text by consistently focusing on the relationship and interaction between the empire and its subjects. Okay? So now, how do we examine the biblical text through the empire studies lens? We've got the framework, now we need to start putting some drywall up. The goal, this investigation involves examining the imperial propaganda. What do I mean by that? The imperial propaganda. What is that?
The coins.
What's that?
The architecture.
Yes. What is the message of the empire to its subjects? And how do we do that? Through coins, through architecture, through the sources we've already talked about. The goal is to examine the imperial propaganda from the sovereign elites exerted on those that are dominated, and then to ask the question, how does that propaganda interact with the biblical text? Do you see why up front I'm having you guys focus consistently on Rome? What are we doing? Why are you reading Suetonius? Why are you establishing a date? Why are you doing an emperor paper? Why are you looking at coins? What are we doing? What's that?
Setting the stage.
Yes. We're asking the question, what is Rome saying? Because you cannot see how the biblical text interacts with Rome if you don't even know what Rome is saying. You've got to hear their voice first before you can hear the echo of their voice in the Scriptures. Before you can answer the question, how is the text interacting with the empire? The key data, we've already talked about, frescoes, inscriptions. I'm going to pull your guys' extra credit. I'm going to add in some of my own, and we're going to go through, and we're just going to be asking questions like, what is Rome trying to say with this coin? You got to remember, coin's not very big. They only have a small amount of space to get across the message they want. So everything they choose will be important. And we'll just look at coin after coin, or we'll look at architecture for maybe even a whole class period and just say, what are they trying to get across? What are they trying to say? Every time a peasant holds this coin, or every time somebody, what would they be thinking? Every time they walked past this altar at the apex of the city of the road in Asia Minor at Ephesus, what would they be looking at and what would they be seeing? That's the questions we're going to be asking. Okay? And trust me, I won't even say that. Never mind. It's always funny whenever you're getting into this, and sometimes I feel like I have people going, what does this have to do with the New Testament at all? I'm glad that's where you're at. If that's where you're at, because it has a lot to do with it. Okay. But we're also, once we get this stuff in place, then this will lead us to our questions. Our questions will be like, how do subjects engage with the sovereigns? How do the dominated engage with the dominant? Is it always complicit? Are they always in agreement? Is it always rebellion? That's something that we're going to find here in a minute. James C. Scott says every time there's an interaction between the sovereign and the dominant, the dominants are always rebelling in some way. Really? That's not always true. Is it with persistent disdain? Is it with resilient loyalty? Is it the only resistance or rebellion through violence? Or is there other ways of rebelling? Vaclav Havel, let me bring this into modern day some. Vaclav Havel was the president of the Czech Republic after the Velvet Revolution in 1991. And guess what Vaclav Havel was before he became the president? He was a playwright. He was a writer of plays. And during the time period in which the dictators were over the Czech Republic, his plays intentionally were being used to subvert the agenda of the dominant. His plays would have, for example, he has one called The Memorandum. And in The Memorandum, it's this, on this piece of paper, it's this this code, not really a code, it's a message that's written in a language that was created by those that are in dominance, and in order to be the only language that has absolutely no ambiguity. It's a language that eradicates all ambiguity. It is as precise as you can get. The problem is, no one can understand it. Even the people teaching the language can't even understand what the message says because the language is something so foreign to them, and yet it's the most precise language ever developed. And you get to the very end of this play, the memorandum, and what you find is that the message that's on the paper when it's decoded, it says, abandon the language and everything attached to it because it's the downfall of society, not the creation of it. And people are going, oh, what a silly playwright. And yet what he's doing is he's saying, this is the message of the dictatorship to us. That their system is what will bring us into glory. But what I'm telling you is their system is actually what's going to be our demise. He became a fugitive because his plays were so wildly popular. And Vaclav Havel says this. He says, society is a very mysterious animal with many faces and hidden potentialities. And it's extremely short-sighted to believe that the face society happens to be presenting to you at a given moment is its only true face. None of us knows all the potentialities that slumber in the spirit of the population. Oh, that's good stuff. What's he saying? What's that? Vaclav Havel. Vaclav... Ooh, is it A? Yes, it's A. Vaclav Havel. It's an L at the very end of Havel. Vaclav Havel. From that understanding, I want us now to look at James C. Scott's work and to go deeper to see what he's actually offered us. James C. Scott, remember, we've already talked about. He wrote the two books, Weapons of the Weak in 1987, and he also wrote the book in 1990, the book Domination Arts of Resistance. James C. Scott is an anthropologist, a sociologist. And in his first book, Weapons of the Weak, he documents his time inside of a Malaysian agrarian community. So, agrarian meaning, farming community. And what he was there, he gets there at a time period in which the whole community is in disarray because the people that own the land that these peasants are working on have just now introduced new technology to develop the efficiency of the production of their crops. Well, whenever you have new technology that adds to efficiency, what it does to an economic society of peasants is destroys it. And so what he starts to do, he starts to observe the way in which the peasants are interacting with the rich, the dominant. And this is what he noticed. During Scott's observation, he began to notice a distinct incongruency with what the peasants would say to the rich to their faces. And then whenever they went behind closed doors, their conversation would be the complete opposite of what they just said. What he also noticed was whenever the rich were speaking to the peasants in public, when the rich went behind closed doors, they were saying the exact opposite. You've experienced that in your own lives, haven't you? You didn't need a sociologist to tell you that sometimes when people say something to your face, it isn't what they truly think or say about you behind closed doors. Right? Do we need a testimony from the girls' dorm in here, or are we good? But the implications of this in a society like we have the biblical text arising in are pretty hard to underestimate. In Domination and the Arts of Resistance, he takes his study from Weapons of the Weak and he begins to develop some principles, some sociological parameters, basically. What he notices is this. In a dominant and dominated relationship, the settings of dominance deny the dominated the privilege of trading slap for slap or an insult for an insult. In other words, in the setting of an empire, the people that are dominated don't have the ability to talk about their frustration or insults the way in which the people that are in charge do. It's not an equal divvying up of power. As a result, Scott suggests that the subjects have to engage in more unique ways of being resistant. Quoting from Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, this is actually interesting because this is advice from a dying slave to his son. This is what he says. Live with your head in the lion's mouth. I want you to overcome him with yeses, undermine him with grins, agree him to death and destruction, let him swallow you till they vomit or bust wide open, and learn it to the youngins. What's he saying? The way that you subvert, the way that you destroy the power of the dominance is by obeying them to the T. We'll get to, remember the Ethiopian proverb we talked about yesterday. When the great Lord passes, you bow down deeply and silently fart. What he began to establish was that the hegemony that an empire is trying to put on its people, the ideological control, when the empire says, this is what you were to think, this is how you were to act, what he began to find is that as much as the empire wants it to be the way it isn't always the way that it is. That the people down below don't buy into what we'll eventually call the sovereign myth, the sovereign narrative. And he does this by developing a couple of key terms. Number one, the public transcript. Public transcript, that's very important. Public transcript. And what the public transcript is this. This is the interaction between the sovereigns and the subjects in this space that is common to them both. The public space. So public is pointing to where in which the interaction occurs. And the transcript is it's kind of like think of a court of law. The transcript is exactly the way in which things happened or will happen or do happen. The public transcript is this. The interaction between the sovereigns and the subjects in which the sovereigns tell the subjects, this is the way you will act. And that takes place in the public transcript. Everybody follow me on that? Because this all builds on itself. So if you don't understand the first one, I want to re-explain it. Everybody got the public transcript? This is right now. This is our public transcript. The way in which we interact in this classroom, because of the title that a group of board or of trustees gave me, there are then set expectations in this interaction, this public transcript. Right? Okay. And I know what you're thinking. Did you just compare yourself to a dictator? Well, some of you will believe that anyway. But then he also noticed there isn't just a public transcript. There are hidden transcripts. This is the second element. Hidden transcripts. Hidden transcripts. But notice I'm using the word transcripts there, plural. Because there is a hidden transcript for the rich or the dominant. And there is a hidden transcript for the dominated or the subjects. Two hidden transcripts, and let me define what that means. The hidden transcript for the sovereigns, or for the ones that are in control, their goal is to hide or to conceal the reality of their futility. In other words, behind the closed doors, the sovereigns of any given situation or any given empire will try to make sure that what they know is true behind closed doors never makes it out into the public transcript. They want to keep it hidden. For a couple of reasons. Number one, if there is ever disunity shown in the public transcript amongst the sovereigns, it makes their power tentative or tenuous. It makes their power shaky. All of a sudden, there's a chink in the armor. You can see the significance of this with the whole WikiLeaks situation that's occurring. You know what I mean? Why is Julian Assange one of the most sought-after fugitives, well, I mean, he's technically in custody now, in the world? Because what WikiLeaks is doing is it's taking the hidden transcripts of the sovereigns and it's throwing it out into the public transcript. And boy, whenever you're starting to see things that, what did the ambassador of this country say behind closed doors about the ambassador of that country? That's a problem. You see the issue? Their purpose is to make sure they keep any disunity behind closed doors, because if they show their disunity in public, everything could fall. Second thing is their purpose is to conceal their futility. They know they're not as powerful as they really portray themselves to be, but they can't let anybody know that, because if they do, then an uprising may see a way in which they can overthrow them in their power. There's an example that James C. Scott uses in his book of a particular peasant group, of a sovereign group, that they part of their narrative of dominance was to show that they were really fat and they had big feet. That was one of the ways that they symbolically exerted their dominance over the peasants. Well, what one of the peasants, their whole power collapsed on itself whenever the peasants found out that this guy in particular that was ruling over them was actually stuffing his shirt and was wearing shoes that were actually too big for him. He had kept that hidden behind closed doors in order to keep his power intact. That was a part of his hidden transcript. He really wasn't what he was portraying himself to be. And that's why whenever you get a lot of... the point of the public transcript is to overwhelm the masses with so much awe that the person that is before you is actually bigger than what they really are. You know what I mean? You follow me there? You can make the connections yourself. This happens even today. Matter of fact, there's some people in the UK that don't understand why they still have the Queen of England. They're like, she doesn't politically do anything. But man, when you're in the presence of the Queen of England, there is so much grandeur that you just feel overwhelmed in some sense. But it's more symbolic than it is reality. They keep that in the hidden transcript. Even if she doesn't have power, if Parliament is dominating all the power, that won't come out. Because if it does, it could actually cause problems for the whole political system of England. So that's the sovereign hidden transcript, the dominance hidden transcript. But the peasants have a hidden transcript themselves, don't they? This is what you find with the peasants saying, yeah, I know I bow down to him, but if really ever it came to it, I could take him. Would they ever say that in the public transcript? No, why not? Why not? What? Yeah, because more than likely, even if they could take that one person, the power of the dominant would destroy them. Hidden transcript is a place in which those that are dominated talk about and discuss their displeasure with the public reality, the public transcript. But they can't let that out in the public transcript for fear of ramifications. And so you have to have several different elements in order for a hidden transcript to develop. I promise you, all of this talk is going somewhere. I promise you. I know the temptation right now in this moment is to check out, but I promise you, it's going to come to a head. Okay? Matter of fact, the dividends this will pay off here in just a bit, I think will be huge. Because what this will open up the text in a way you've never looked at it before. But you got to go through this, okay? Okay. We're not going to talk about that part. The key question, though, of the subject's hidden transcript is, how is it communicated in the public transcript? Because there is this insatiable desire that what you feel behind closed doors, if you're the subject, you want to get it out some way, but you know that you don't want to experience the ramifications of doing that. But they do allow it to seep out several different ways. Number one, there will be sometimes an explicit revelation of the hidden transcript of the subject. Explicit, where it comes out, it's very clear. But they'll even do this in one of two ways. Number one, sometimes they will make sure that their explicit revelation of their displeasure comes out in the public transcript at a safe distance to insulate themselves from any ramifications. First, I experienced this firsthand whenever I was in the Middle East the summer after 9/11. If you could put that sentence together, you'd understand they probably weren't really happy that this white, Americans walking down their street. So we were walking down our street. Part of our language lesson for the day was they taught us some phrases. They gave us some money. They say, go use the Arabic language to buy some food. Where should we go? Just go. Okay. So we were in this like back alley of one of the offshoot roads, and we're walking, and I kept feeling rocks. Like, I remember the first rock I felt, I kind of looked down like, this is a dirt road. And I look around and everyone's just doing their normal business. And I kept going a little bit more and I was like, huh, maybe it just flipped up from one of their shoes or something. A little bit further, fell another one. I was like, okay, there's no way. Kept going. It happened probably a dozen times. What was being said? The hidden transcript was coming out in the public transcript, but from a safe distance so that they couldn't have any ramifications. Right? They didn't like me. They didn't want me there. But they weren't going to say that in the public transcript. But the hidden transcript was made known. And so we got back to the main road. but this happens all the time. Matter of fact, George Orwell, this is actually a pretty cool quote. He was an English colonizer in Burma, actually, in the 1920s. And this is the way he describes some of the interaction with the people there. He says, anti-European feeling was very bitter in Burma. No one had the guts to raise a riot. Notice his language even there. Catch that? No one had the guts to raise a riot because they knew what would happen to them. But if a European woman went through the bazaars alone, somebody would probably spit Betelgeuse all over her dress. Oh, I'm sorry, ma'am. And they walk away laughing. When a nimble Burman tripped me on the football field and the referee, another Burman, looked the other way, the crowd yelled with hideous laughter. In the end, the sneering yellow faces of the young men that met me everywhere, the insults hooted after me when I was at a safe distance, got badly on my nerves. The young Buddhist priests were the worst of all. He knows they're not happy, but he can't pin it on anyone. Because one of the ways of showing the hidden transcript in the public transcript is doing it in a way in which you can't really be caught. And yet the message is very clear. That may have something to say about texts eventually, right? We have a couple minutes left. Let me go ahead and give you an example so you can see this will pay off. Okay? Because we need to keep actually developing this some more. But I don't want to do it at the cost of you guys not believing me. Turn with me to Romans chapter 13. What is significant about Romans 13? This is the passage that is always used to you better obey the government. Everything they say you need to do. You need to support them. You need to be in support of your government. And am I going to say that's not... No, I'm not going to say it's totally wrong. What I'm going to say is I think there's something bigger happening in this passage that maybe hidden transcripts can reveal. What we have right before, leading into chapter 13, is really important discussion. He says, verse 9, chapter 12, "Love must be sincere. Hate what is evil. Cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Honor one another above yourselves. Never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord. Be joyful in hope, patient in affliction, faithful in prayer. Share with God's people who are in need. Practice hospitality." This kind of sounds like, you could have just said, love your neighbor, Paul. "Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Mourn with those who mourn. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be proud, but be willing to associate with people of low position. Do not be conceited. Do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everybody. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone." Did you hear that? If it is possible, as far as it depends on you. In other words, they may not allow peace. But as far as it depends on you, you live at peace with everyone. "Do not take revenge, my friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, 'It is mine to avenge, not you. I will repay,' says the Lord. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities." Stop. Did we shift topics? No. Because if you're Paul writing in the 60s, wouldn't the government be considered an enemy with the way he's treating you and the other apostles? Who's in charge?
Nero.
And what is Nero doing around this time? Burning Christians. Getting ready to lop off Peter and then Paul. And so the whole enemy talk of chapter 12 is directly related to the governing authorities talk in chapter 13. Okay? Everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities. But he's not saying start a violent coup. He's saying, Christians, you got to know how to respond to a government that hates you, to a sovereign elite that is subjecting you to ridicule and even death. How do you react to them? You subvert them by the way you love them. And then he goes on. This gets even better. "For there is no authority except that which God has established." Oh, man. Did you catch the hidden transcript? You don't say that in the public space of Rome. Why? Let's keep reading. "The authorities that exist have been established by God." Oh, man. "Consequently, he who rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted. And those who do so will bring judgment on themselves." Here's what's happened in those two verses alone. Here's what's happened. Rome's going, "I'm not a servant of your God. I dominate your God." And Paul's going, "No. You actually serve my God. You're not in control." Rome says, "Yes, we are. Look at my sword." And Paul says, "Kill me with the sword. You're not in control. You are the servant of God." That is not something Rome would say, "Shucks, thanks." Rome would say, now I'm going to kill you. And yet, what's weird is Rome has a problem. Because what does he say in verse 2? You got to submit to them. Rome's going, I'm going to kill you for obeying me. How do you handle that if you're the Roman authorities? What do you do? You're saying I'm serving your God, which is not, that's blasphemous against the empire of Rome. And yet you're also saying that you need to obey whatever I say. Even if I say I'm going to kill you, you say, okay, I will obey you by having you kill me. How do you punish this? It keeps going. Verse 3, for rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. In other words, he's saying, so if you're doing right, what can they do to you? Even if your whole understanding of the way in which they serve completely undermines them. Do you want to be free from fear of the one in authority? Then do what is right and he will commend you. For he is God's servant to do you good. Even after he says he will commend you, he then says he's God's servant, which would tick them off. They don't believe that they are Yahweh's servant. They believe they are God's themselves. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword for nothing. In other words, yeah. He is God's servant. What's the emphasis in this passage? He is God's servant, an agent of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. Therefore, it is necessary to submit to the authorities, not only because of the possible punishment, but also because of conscience. And then he goes on and says, this is why you also pay taxes, for the authorities are God's servants. What's his emphasis? They are God's servants. And Rome would say, no, we're not. But their hidden transcript says yes. And this is how they subvert the kingdom. All this is going somewhere. Hang with me because it affects every passage in the New Testament. Love you guys. See you tomorrow.